This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Hello everyone. My name's Sam and I find talking in public quite scary. So apologies for my shaky voice. It's my absolute pleasure to host this amazing group of people today. I'll be chairing the discussion, which will be a kind of informal talk, even though it feels like a very formal room, about our different approaches to trans activism within New Zealand and the world, and dealing with the media and media stories, both stories that are told about us and stories that are created by us. On the panel today, we have Aaron Wu, who is one of the founders of Equation. He's currently on the Auckland Council Rainbow Panel, has worked for Rainbow Youth as the National Projects Coordinator, and is an all-round great guy. Con Myers is an actor, writer and director who's been involved in Breaking Boundaries, the Writers Festival Same Same But Different, the Legacy Project, and is currently working with Shortland Street, advising about their trans character, who's a regular on the show, which I think is particularly for trans masculine people, maybe the first on Shortland Street. Next we have Sophie LaBelle, who's currently touring the world, and we're very lucky to have her here in New Zealand. She's flown all the way from, her last stop was Paris, I believe. She is from Quebec and writes the assigned male comic and is an activist, teacher and artist. And on the end we have Emily Rakati, who is the Tangata Whenua rep at Rainbow Youth and a spokesperson and one of the founding members for No Pride in Prison and all-round activist and wonderful person who's smashing the cis-hetero patriarchy and white supremacist capitalism, which is wonderful. So I wanted to start with saying what today is not. We're not going to do a kind of trans 101 because I personally find it boring and this is all about me, so I have the power to chair. But also, I imagine that most people who come along to the panel know a little bit about trans stuff, and I feel like that would be spending a lot, would not be doing the knowledge of these amazing speakers justice, since they can kind of talk much, much more in depth and further into the work that they do. I thought maybe we could start with from each of you, around your approaches to activism or media representation, and a kind of brief explanation of the work that you do. Starting with whoever is brave enough to go first.
I was only giving it because there's two microphones.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I guess for me, I recently went to Palmerston North to celebrate the 45th anniversary of the Polynesian Panthers, and that it was such an amazing hui that I got to participate in. And one of the questions that that was fired at our way was, what kind of activism do you do? You know, and I actually felt really embarrassed to talk about it because I was like, oh, I'm not out picketing enough or chaining myself up to things enough. And I was like, oh, you know, I was feeling a bit, you know. But then I thought about it, you know, my form of activism is actually being, you know, living the way that I wanted to live, to be the person that I am, as a trans person, working in a secular organization which doesn't actually understand anything about transgender identity at all. So I think shaking that up every single day for me at work has just been my form of activism, that is slowly educating people around, hey, you know, we don't live in a place of just binary, that we need to decolonize gender and we need to look at the different aspects of gender identity. And so I guess that for me, through education and also, you know, through some of the projects that I've been doing, that's, I guess that's my form of activism every day, to challenge the status quo and also challenge the media as well, by producing narratives that is wholly our own. Yeah,
I'm quite similar to you in that respect. Like, it's taken me a long time to work out that the fact that that going to protests gives me major anxiety, and that that's kind of not the form of activism that works best for who I am and what my skills are, and to come to terms with that. I mean, the activism that I like to do the most is creative activism and looking at narrative approaches and representation in those narrative approaches as well. I think looking at the things which get me the most angry, and then addressing some of those issues, and they were things like seeing a lot of trans narratives that didn't authentically represent us, that were created by, acted by, and, you know, promoted by non-trans people, casting non-trans people, and, you know, and that's so problematic for so many reasons. I think, yeah, and so looking at that, and then, I mean, my work with the Legacy Project was realizing that then we needed to start writing some of those things, and then so I wrote a few things which had trans characters in them, and then realized that another problem was that supporting trans actors to actually then portray those roles was difficult as well because of all the issues in relation, you know, how much harder it is to be a trans actor than and be in those spaces. I'm nervous talking with a microphone. And another thing I think is about that self-care stuff and that community care stuff. And so, realizing for myself that looking after myself and looking after my friends is activism. Even things like, you know, getting out of bed in the morning and eating 3 meals a day and things like that, you know, are activist approaches. So I guess that's kind of an overview of the stuff that I do.
All right. Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here. I'm really glad to be part of this wonderful panel with all those people. I arrived in New Zealand yesterday afternoon, so don't mind me if I'm just like, if I just go on. Anyway, so I draw a comic about activism and about trans issues. Oh, look at you. And I've been doing it for 2 years, and before that, I was actually training myself on stuff, mostly because I've been doing activism both in trans and feminist communities for about a decade, but also I've been implied in Montreal's ecologist movement and also the student movement, for which I kind of ruined my health in this. Yeah? And I started this comic for mainly two reasons. One was that, you know, I was getting older, and I couldn't chain myself on stuff like I used to. And I would see younger activists. That's everything to do with my back. Actually, it's just my back. But by the way, sorry for the strong French Canadian accent. I was born that way. Like, I didn't ask to. Anyway, I'm slowly transitioning with my comic. You know, I'm transitioning towards a more international accent. Sorry for the bad puns. Oh my god. So I would see younger activists. You know, people that just arrived on the activism scene, and I would see them just throwing everything they got into activism and spending all their energy debating with devil's advocates on Facebook, endlessly, people that don't really care about those issues. And I would see those activists just giving all they got to the cause. And I was like, we've built knowledge. We've been building community knowledge for decades, and still we keep repeating the same stuff, and we're losing a lot of energy in this. And what can I do to summarize everything that I've been doing while doing activism in Montreal? And so that's how I started my comic, mainly to end useless debates on social networks with a joke, and like turning the issues into stuff that is at the same time empowering for trans communities, but also gives kind of tips for people that want to educate themselves, really. And so that's one of the reasons I started the comic. The other reason is mostly because of the media. I was talking with some over eggs this morning about the fact that before doing that comic, I was, you might have seen the posters. You might have seen the posters. It says that I'm a legendary camp counselor. Who wrote that? Anyway. I was organizing this this summer camp for trans children in Quebec, and the media got really interested in it, and so they most of the big media in both Quebec and Canada wanted interviews with me and with the kids mostly, and I would see them just be so problematic towards those kids' bodies mostly, and towards trans issues in general, and they would feel entitled to give so many personal information about our bodies and our identity, and like, anyway, that was just really gross. And yeah, when I came back from that camp that year, that's when I decided to take upon me to create this comic. And so I'm doing it full time now. I kind of let the chaining behind me. I don't chain myself on stuff anymore. I know if I have a good occasion to do it, like give me ideas.
I mean, we could chain ourselves to something now. Like we don't. Like,
yes. Yes.
Yes. Okay, let's protest the shoes that I'm wearing today. So I'm Emmy, and I wear a couple hats at the moment. So I'm here as a tangata whenua rep for Emma Youth, and also as like a really angry communist. So forgive me if I slip between registers. I think about activism and I use a framework from a theorist called Manuel de Landa, who does, it's mostly a military historian, but he speaks about getting things done on terms of three layers. There's tactics, strategics, and logistics. The tactical is how to win a battle. So if you need to kill someone, then shooting the guy is tactics. And strategics is assembling these battles into a campaign. So how to turn battles into wars and how to win those wars. That's the layer of strategics. And finally, there's logistics, which is how to assemble society or a group or an organization or a movement to carry out these campaigns. And if you're not operating on each of those levels effectively, then you will be killed. For non-partner prisons, tactically, we've made some mistakes. So 2 years ago, we tried a direct action with three people, and I got tombstone pile driven by a security guard and he broke my arm. And I learned from that, and I learned from a lot of examples, and I look at a lot of military history. I read a lot of history of colonization in this country, which is basically the best lesson that you will ever get in how things operate, is watching how this country was invaded by the New Zealand government. that's the really the abstract principle that I look at when I try to consider what we should be doing is, if, hypothetically, this was a war, how would we want to win that war? And when I say hypothetically, I don't mean hypothetically at all, because this is a war. As far as I'm concerned, the land wars are still going, so that's always been my outlook. But just take off my angry communist hat. Rainbow Youth, I think of as largely a logistical and strategical level for activism to take place. So there's education work, there's making sure that kids don't kill themselves before they get old enough to take up a fight. Maybe that's a very instrumental way of thinking about what these young people can do. But we need to think about strategically how we're going to fix anything if we're all dead, or if we don't know who we are, or if we have shitty politics because we were only ever spoken to by people who wanted to do Trans 101. So that's kind of how I would see the split, is that No Pride of Prisons is largely a tactical and strategical organisation, and Rainbow Youth is largely a strategical and logistical organisation. And there's value at all of those layers, because if you fuck up on any one of them, then you fuck everything up. There's a tendency to valorise direct action, I think, in activist spaces, kind of go like, well, if you haven't changed yourself to anything, or if you haven't yelled at a cop in the last 12 months, maybe you're fake. And that's not a useful attitude. But I do think that it is really important to take direct action, because it's very, very easy to ignore everything else that we do. It's very easy not to notice this kind of educational work or support work or advocacy work that goes on. And, you know, both No Pride in Prisons and Rainbow Youth do a lot of that kind of behind-the-scenes, non-valorous, non-sexy, but very, very important work. And, you know, so does everyone on this panel, and so do most of you, to be honest. Maybe this is a very long, condescending ramble about stuff that you already know. but I hope that, at the very least, thinking about the three layers and how we operate those, I think, can be a useful way of organising activism to make sure that we do, you know, we do win battles and we do win wars and we do have the resources to, you know, to do that.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't want to drop that.
In the last couple of weeks in New Zealand, there's been a lot in the media around the homosexual law reform, and I noticed a certain privileging of certain narratives around how that law change came about, the heroes of that. Do you think, and this is for any or all of you, how do you think that privilege plays a role in the sorts of stories or the sorts of people that the media chooses to either demonise or sanctify? What's the other word? Like, make into heroes.
Some of you might have been able to come to the 30th law reform party that, well, not party, but celebration that we had for the Auckland Council to talk about, you know, we invited a whole lot of people for that day to come along to talk about, you know, the process and everything. But something that really did struck me was just that this is not over. You know, this celebration is, you know, that day for me was, you know, being one of the only trans person on the panel, you know, was highlighting the point that, cool, that there are some laws that have privileged some people in our community, but there's so much more that we still need to remember and fight and remember the lives of the people that we have lost in our personal lives or in our own community. And I think it's also rehash that over and over again for some of us who have that energy to remind other people that this is not over, and also to challenge, you know, the people of influences with media as well, that cool, this day is a day of celebration, but there's also still so much work to be done. Yeah.
Thank you.
There was this campaign that, the first time I got really implied with trans activism was a couple of years ago when Quebec's government went on this campaign against homophobia. And I'm an elementary school teacher. That's my career. It's been put aside for comic purposes. But it was mostly a campaign that was aimed at schools, elementary schools and high schools. And it was basically just the campaign was about, would you call this person gay? Does that person look gay? And like, it was just so problematic. As somebody who's been working with children and like elementary school levels for most of my life now, this really hit home since I knew that the kids that were being bullied at school weren't people that were bullied because of their romantic or sexual preferences, but because of their gender expression and how they didn't look straight. And that got me really angry to see this campaign that was aiming at saying, oh, we don't look gay, so you can't really hit us. And so, totally. I feel that the narrative that we, that even inside our communities, I mean, I went out in the media against this campaign, and that got me a lot of hate from Pride Montreal and also the big organizations in Quebec because, you know, they were working hard on this. Sorry, I wasn't crying, that was laughing. But it might be a bit of crying, I don't know. This has direct consequences because this campaign has ran through 2 years, and once there was a poster and a part of a commercial that was aired where we'd see a trans person, but it was this binary older trans women, and the commercial would ask, "Would you be transphobic with that person if she was your sister?" Anyway, that was like you would see all this normativity and this kind of behavior that we've been seeing. From what I know, I wasn't born then, but I've been told by many activists that's how it came to be, mostly by historians of the movement, that after the AIDS epidemic, there was this. This kind of push, we have to acknowledge that the most radical parts of what we would call the LGBT communities or the gay and lesbian movement back then, the most radical elements were the first to fall on the battlefield. There was this kind of idea that we had to present like normal people, and often the ones that were put aside by this were trans people, gender non-conforming people, and I feel we're still struggling to find to get our place back in this movement that we started. I mean, the first rebellions, the first times that we stood up against police and against oppression was because of oppression based on gender expression and often race, and so I feel that we still haven't got that place back, and the fact that we're promoting such normative narratives is mostly what keeps us from getting it back.
I think it's like so Aaron was talking before about the council celebration of the 30th anniversary of homosexual reform. This is a different thing that I'm about to completely trash, so I'm sure it was lovely.
Oh, don't conflate the GABA one.
Yeah, to yeah, they were totally different.
That was two
totally different things. Yeah.
just have to clarify that.
Yeah. So there was that one, which was real cool. At Chastity, which is a casino, I'll remind you all. GABA, who are, I'm sorry, they're called Rainbow Auckland now. They're a business association run by wealthy Ponsonby queers. to have their celebration of the 30th anniversary. It was $125 for tickets. They had a prison-themed bar.
What?
Yeah, it's the cutest thing that I've ever seen. And it really kind of summed up this weird... No, not weird, this completely reasonable prioritisation of different people's lives where... Because, you know, when I had my arm broken, the president of GABA, whose name is Heather Carnegie... she's blonde, was sitting in front of me while I was having my handcuffs put on by the cop on my back, telling me how ashamed I should be of myself for ruining the day and making everything really bad, and basically just berated me for the 30 to 45 minutes that it took them to let me see an ambulance. And, like, on its own, that's a horrible thing to do. But then, to after that, after having been criticised for the last, you know, year and a half about the role that prisons play in perpetrating, like, violence that's so bad that I'm not going to say what it is during this conversation. but, you know, to have been blasted with that stuff for the last year and a half, for them to still opt to do a prison thing bar because I guess you can't go to prison just for being a gay anymore, is really interesting because, like, yeah, you can't go to prison because you've, you know, just because you're gay, because that's not a criminal offence anymore. Unfortunately, we're still actually really fucking criminalised, which is why there are so many trans women in prison at the moment. That's why there are still actually a whole bunch of queers who are in prison and wouldn't be there if they weren't queer. But that never occurred to these people because they've never thought outside of that and they've never gone, well, you know, I'm gay, so I can't go to prison for being gay. Well, no, more importantly, you can't go to prison because you're Pākehā. because you're cis, because you aren't caught up in all these little traps that the rest of us have to fucking crawl through every day. There's this campaign to get historical convictions for homosexual activity wiped or forgiven or whatever the technical term is, that older gay men can go overseas again, because you can't do that if you have a criminal conviction. And that's really interesting, because rather than go, well, no, you should be able to go overseas even if you've had a criminal conviction, they've gone, oh, no, ours don't count. We deserve it. The rest of those people who have been convicted for having drugs or selling drugs, they're actually the bad people. So rather than try to deal with the actual violence, they've just gone, oh, no, it shouldn't affect us. It should affect everyone else. That's fine. They earned it by virtue of being too brown or too poor. But we never deserved it. We've accidentally, by being queer, been caught up in this trap that was never meant to affect us. it was meant, you know, if it catches Māori, that's fine, because we conquered them, and if it affects, you know, drug users, well, that's fine, because they made their choice. But I'm a respectable white Ponsonby queer. I run a business. My life is worth, objectively worth, more than anyone else's. This turned into a ramble. It usually does.
I don't know how to follow that. yeah, I guess just the one thing that I was thinking about when talking about the, like, 30-year anniversary, I was like, well, we haven't even reached year zero of removing, of adding gender identity to the Human Rights Act. So, you know, let's have a party when that counter starts. Yeah, I guess just thinking about, because I think about this a lot as well, that I feel like quite uncomfortable in some of the spaces that I'm in because people invite me, or because of privilege and things like that, because people ask me to do things or invite me to spaces where other trans people, particularly like trans women and trans people of colour, aren't invited to. And I feel this sort of weird vibe of wanting to use that privilege to, you know, be like a spy almost. Sometimes I feel like that. Like, I'm sneaking into these spaces being like, you all think that I'm totally respectable. Well, lol. yeah, but at the same time, I feel this weird thing about, what if I start believing in that? Like, what if because I'm in those spaces and then because the way I, you know, have to act again in order to then go, cool, thanks for inviting me here, also my friends are coming, like, or that's cool, but you have missed out all these huge groups, you know, in your discussion about trans issues or things like that. Yeah, and that uncomfortableness about kind of both wanting to appear a lot more genderqueer and gender blurry about things, but also going, then am I losing some ability to go into spaces and do activist work because of that? Like, it's, yeah, and it's, I haven't worked it out, and I know even talking about it sounds kind of weird and stuff like that, but it is something that I think about, you know, that toss-up about the authenticity of myself versus what kind of added changes could I make if I'm more binary and stuff like that. And again, like, even being able to say that, you know, is pointing out that this is a problem, because we have a huge amount of binary privilege for people who, you know, appear binary or are binary trans people. You're going to say something.
Yeah, well, that makes me think of my, you know, international activism, because, you know, I'm traveling most of my time to give talks and being invited in different countries, and I know I have many trans friends who couldn't do that because of document, like legal documents or papers, and not appearing binary enough, or like all those questions about passing, and like, it is a very big privilege to be able to have access to those spaces or to those opportunities to go outside your own country, you know. And that really hits a lot of soft spot in me.
I want to jump on board on this whole binary thing. Okay, cool. Yeah, as someone who works in a very extremely binary workplace, I think, you know, fucking things up from the center is, you know, one of the best ways, you know, like the infiltrator, and then just like just, you know, just fuck things up and fuck with people's mind, you know, it's amazing. It's brilliant. You know, I've had these big, like, bulking, like cis hetero men who have just been so uncomfortable by just the way that, you know, I've come into work. You know, there's some, you know, like, for me, if I get scared, I have a really high-pitched scream. And it's like, Aram, that wasn't very masculine. I'm just like, excuse me, don't put your fucking, like, gender shit on me, you know? And so I'll be like, oh, shit, you know? And it's just like, but with that, you know, it's incredible how much, like, people just need to have to put you in this box of, you know, you have to live up to this masculine or feminine identity in order for them to feel comfortable, and for you to do all the emotional labor, that if they get, you know, like, all pissed off about your identity, it's your problem to deal with all that labor to, you know, expand their mind and all this kind of stuff, which has kind of been really interesting, because I actually started having a mispronoun jar at work. Yeah, where like people had to put money into it, and so I had these big hulking men to be like, it's not in my contract to say that I have to put money in your jar. And I'm like, well, you know what, when you can be more respectful, then I'll put it away. And you know, it's taken 3 months for some of these big hulking men to, but you know with that, and you know, it's interesting because at work I've had to be more masculine than I'd like to be, but it's actually really interesting that this progression, it's you know, they've gone back to talk to their wives or talk to people in their own community, where now that if someone actually mispronouns me, they actually start jumping on board to be like, sorry, who are you talking about, you know? And that's actually quite incredible, even though, like, for 3 months, it's just been like, fuck me, I hate everybody at my work. But the whole infiltrating, you know, and, you know, I mean, speaking of the different tactics as well, you know, and starting to slowly, like, educate them in that way of, you know, binary, like, it's really unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I just had something to say. This, you made me think about something. A while ago, me and some friends did a kind of presentation at a church, actually, that was talking, because him and his family go there, and he's came out as trans, and it was basically to just kind of give people some understanding about trans issues. And I did a poem which was largely about how confusing and painful I find talking about gender stuff and my own gender and you know, male privilege and female socialization and kind of all that stuff like that. Yeah, and then this one guy comes up to me afterwards and he's like, "Man, you're like the manliest guy I've ever met." And I was like, I knew it was coming from a good place, but I was like, "Thank you." And he's like, "You taught me so much about trans stuff today. Like, that was really cool." But it was so funny that his number one compliment for me was like, "Wow, that was so like hardcore, like a dude."
Mm.
Like, thanks.
A few of you touched on this before, and I just wanted to unpack some of the stuff around how as activists we can practice ways of improving things for trans people, but do so in a way that also highlights things like colonization, things like trans misogyny, things like classism, in ways that don't mean that we're going to charge $125 and go to jail as far.
That's a big question. Like, if anyone had worked out a really good answer for that, we wouldn't be having this panel. You know, we'd be sitting on the rubble of town hall or something. It's really difficult to do activism effectively. I don't really think of this as activism. I think of it as organizing, because you don't to say that this is activism here and everything else is something else really tends to centralize the area of things that get stuff done within a very narrow range of things that you do. I think that there are a range of things that we can organize that work really well, and there's a range of things we can organize that don't work really well. That's maybe a bit of a tautology. But the goal is to do stuff that works really well and not do the stuff that doesn't work really well. Once you figure that one out, things go really well. But it's the working out what does and does not work, which is the really hard bit. And it's taken a really long time, you know, in my life to figure out what works really well and what doesn't. And I'm sure, you know, in 20 years' time, I'll send all the different prison going, "I think I've changed my mind about what works really well and what doesn't." But for the moment, I think that really it's thinking about things from the outside and thinking about how we can let the outside of these things that we're fighting against, how to let that move us. So how to let the outside of Western civilization move us and act in accordance with that is really important way of fighting white supremacy. How to let the outside of prisons, the outside of prison thinking, move us is a really important part of any prison abolitionist program. I mean, Māori stuff. but, you know, dealing with the history of colonization in this country requires us to think the outside of colonization and to let, you know, whatever forces live outside of colonization move us and act through us. I really think that a kind of surrendering of the self and a surrendering of power away from our own agencies and giving it up to, you know, whatever obscure forces exist out there, the things that we need to destroy, has been the most effective way that I have gotten anything done. So giving up on trying to make sense within the world that we want to destroy is really important. So giving up on trying to make sense under white supremacy is an important part of living authentically as Māori, and giving up on trying to be able to continue to exist under white supremacy is an important part of being Māori. And any Māori activism which continues to try to make sense within white supremacy just ends up being, you know, a corporate iwi, or you know, any trans activism which tries to make sense in a cis-sexist world ends up having fucking a prison thing, but I don't know, it's difficult to pin down exactly how we can be complicit in the outsides of these things. I guess it really has been for me, I look for what was the most frightening, what was the most terrorizing about stuff. So the most terrorizing thing about the outside of prisons is that maybe we need to consider that people's lives are never just disposable, and thinking about how we can live in ways that take as a given that nobody's life is disposable. And starting from that base premise, or starting with like a given true thing, has been really useful for me in finding what is the right thing to do and what is the wrong thing to do. I don't know how much sense that makes. I'm on a lot of cold medication today.
No, I totally agree with that as well. And yeah, that idea about no matter what, everyone's life is worth it, you know, everyone is worthy and everyone is loved as a absolute non-negotiable, unconditional basis to things. Because yeah, it's too easy to go to throw people away. I'm just trying to remember what the question was as well. It was like,
can you repeat? It wasn't written down. it was how do we work in ways that kind of like what you were saying, where we with the campaign around homophobia being like, if you look nice, then you don't deserve to be bullied, which kind of implies that if you don't look nice, then you do deserve to be bullied.
Mm.
So how do we make sure that all of our people, particularly the most marginalised voices, are heard within our sorts of activism?
Well, then, you know, it's intersectional critical thinking always with everything, and that's kind of what I was thinking about before as well, is that, you know, the spaces that I have access to when I'm presenting in a more binary way and things like that, I'm always going, who isn't here? Who isn't being heard? Who can't access this because of money, because of disability, because of class or race or all of these things like that? And pointing that out, I think, I don't speak on issues of which that don't affect me like that, because there are obviously much better people to talk about those things, but pointing out when those people aren't around to be heard is kind of, I guess, one of the main things that I do in that space as well. Because it's easy unless you're going, unless you're thinking about those things to go, oh, of course it makes sense to charge $125 and, you know, to get into things like that, where it's like, if you'd asked anyone that wasn't in the in-group of which you're part of, they would have said, hey, that's ridiculous.
I remember when I was younger, you know, I would spend, when I was 7, 8, 9 year old, I would spend hours at the library just trying to find a book that would, you know, represent me, or just like that has a character that looks like me. And I get that a lot drawing this comic, you know, people that see themselves in my characters without me even talking about the issues. You know, I have a deaf trans character that appears sometimes in my comic. I never talk about deaf communities issues because I'm not deaf, I don't know much about it. It's just, I just put that character there, and I get messages so often of people that are just so thankful that I have this character without even mentioning this particular struggles that this character goes through. And I feel that representation is something that's very important this way. And I get messages often from movie producers or people that are writing a book and they want to include trans characters, and they ask me for advices on how to include trans characters. And I don't know, it seems so absurd to me that we're seen as being such a so outside of society that we need like instruction manuals to just have a character that is from our community just in a book, you know, while just mentioning that character is trans without analyzing trans misogyny and like particular struggles. You don't need to be an academic, you don't need to study gender and stuff to be able to write a character that happens to be trans, you know. And people have this view of our communities, and even more of, you know, more people that are situated in more intersectional positions than I am. People have this view that they need to be specialized in us to just mention us. And that isn't true. And I feel that representation has this power. I mean, I don't know if anyone's like me, but when I was younger, I would, anytime there was a gender non-conforming character in a movie, I would have a copy of that movie, and I would just run through the same sequence or the same scene of the movie again and again and again, just to see myself in that character. And so, yeah, produce more characters and include us more. That doesn't mean that you have to read everything by Julia Serrano, and like you don't need a degree to include diversity in cultural stuff.
I think, you know, it's all good and well to talk about intersectionality and a lot of, but for me, it's also making sure that I'm not being elitist in that sense of, you know, the community that I work in and the job that I'm in. A lot of the times, you know, these frameworks, these ideologies are still a very Western concept and very Western construct of how we negotiate and deal with people in that way, that can, you know, often further separate us, you know. And I think one of the things that I've been teaching myself a lot is actually giving myself my own consent to be okay to be the, you know, I don't know what color I am, but, you know, the whole, you know, angry POC person, you know, of not being tone police on a day-to-day basis, but consent myself that I can be that person and I can be that angry person, because these issues are my everyday life. They're the people that I work with, their everyday life. But also, how do we move things in secular groups where a lot of people don't understand this kind of like the intersectional differences of what this might affect this, because of this might affect this in that way. And that's something that, you know, that, you know, for me as someone who works in these communities, I'm very aware of the cultural frameworks that some people might be coming from that I have to work around, you know, that I cannot actually put my, you know, concepts and you know, so be it, a very, very Western ideology framework sometimes, and enforce it onto, you know, because that would be no better or a modern form of colonization through theory, you know. but still being able to be true and stay true to who I am, because I work in a very 90% of who I work with are people of color, and you know, when it comes to decolonization and the concept of decolonizing gender in a mostly Māori and Pacific demographic and community that I work in, you know, there has to be a lot of consultation and consent from you know, elders that I to not come from another framework of, no, this is how you have to think, this is how da 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 da. Yeah.
So I heard the word colonization, I was like, so like speaking like specifically as like a Māori person, whenever we want to talk about like gender and sexuality and stuff, there's always this hard limit that we come up against, and that's that all of our discourses and all of the long conversations about what bodies mean and what bodies touching each other can mean, all of that knowledge was massacred when we were invaded, and all of those conversations were murdered and filled up mass graves all up and down this country. that's the absolute limitation for us, is that as Indigenous people, there is always a point we walk up against it and go thus far and no further. There's nothing more that we can know about what that means, because it was taken from us. As like a queer Māori person, we didn't know what the word for queer was in our language till 1980, when Ngahui and Seawe Kotuku was looking at a manuscript of the history of Hinemoa and Tutanekai, who are two lovers from the Te Arawa tradition. And the story is quite well known in most places. It's just about Hinemoa loves Tutanekai, even though he's not a noble family or anything, he's just a flute player. But she falls in love with him and she runs off and they presumably have kids. And that's fine, and that's great, but there's actually way more to that story. And so Mahuia looked at an original manuscript from the 1800s when the story was first transcribed in Te Reo Māori and then translated into English, and the translator left out a lot of shit. So Tutanekai actually had what is called in the text Hoa Takatapui, which sounds a lot like just a lover who is a guy, and that's actually a really significant part of the original text, is the negotiation of that very complex relationship that's going on when Hinemoa falls in love with Tutanekai, but he has Hoa Takatapui called Tiki. And if it hadn't been for one scholar one time noticing one word in one manuscript, we never would have known to call ourselves Takatapui now, because that would have just been gone. And that's kind of it, isn't it? That for us, everything is super precarious. And, you know, Pākehā don't have to worry quite so much about what they call themselves or where their stories come from, because they never got invaded, because they were the ones invading. But there's no absolute limit that they'll come up against when they try to think about their history. Or, you know, if there is, at least there's a written record of it somewhere. At least there hasn't been, you know, an active government running their country trying to stop that history out wherever it is. And so in like a modern context, in terms of practice, how we teach is really important, because if we don't teach Māori kids about takatapuitanga, we're back in that same situation again, where, you know, in 100 years, I don't want my mokopuna to have to look back through, you know, maybe this, this transcript here, to try to figure out what to call themselves. I want those knowledges to survive. And, you know, for so long, the queer movement in this country has made no effort whatsoever to try to make sure that, like, tikanga Māori, but, like, tikanga Māori takatapui in particular, has had any place in movement whatsoever, let alone, like, a really important one, which I think it deserves. With that said, like, a lot of people do a lot of really good work, like Aaron and, like, Rainbow Youth, who I initially, you know, this isn't to say, like, it's great, because when I joined up, I was like, fuck Rainbow Youth, and that's why I joined. But they're actually really good people. And, you know, but it's important, because I was really angry, because a lot of the work that was being done by primarily Pākehā queers was not catering to the needs of Māori queers. And, you know, that's been a priority at Rainbow Youth for the last 2 years now. I think they're doing really, really well. But it's really easy not to do really well. A lot of people don't. Gabba don't. Fucking prison.
I have about 10 million more questions on my piece of paper, and I was supposed to leave time for doing Q&A, but we've gone way over time already.
Really?
What's the time here?
It's 7 past 3, and we're supposed to finish at 3.
Time is an illusion, Sam.
Yes. I'm not sure if you guys need to run away, or we can open it up to one or two questions.
I'm sleeping here.
All right, then I'll throw it out to the audience for one or two questions for the group, or for one or two people, or whatever you want, really.
Thanks. This is for Sophie. I really like your comic, by the way. It's awesome. What's been the hardest thing doing your comic and starting it up?
The hardest thing... Well, a couple of weeks after I started it, just a couple of weeks, like I had maybe like 60 followers, all from my university and from my group of friends. And still, TERFs managed to find it and get really angry at it. TERFs stands for, I know, no trans 101. Sorry, Sam. I'm sorry. I'm going to say it anyway. Stands for trans exclusionary radical feminist. Feminist in brackets.
Radical in brackets.
Yes. They're radically trans-exclusionary, though.
There we go.
And so, yeah, I got filed on this website, and they managed to find every bit of information they could about me, and they just started, like, producing lots of things about me, especially as I said, I was working with kids, and so, you know, a trans activist working with children, oh my God. And yeah, that really hurt me a lot, and I really reconsidered drawing the comic over, like, at all. And I was like, is this really worth it? Because it was really putting my teaching career on the ice. And yeah, that's actually when I decided to go to really make it a bigger project, because there was more to lose at stake, as I was already filed and I was already being watched by those groups, by those hating groups, and that made me so anxious that I wouldn't sleep at night for many weeks. And after that, you know, many other groups came along because they didn't like my comic, and so that apparently was a good enough reason to start creating those hating groups about me. You know, people don't like a comic. They just, let's just buy a diamond to mock this author, and they had to do that. They do that, and yeah, that was probably the biggest challenge, was to decide to fight back, and I feel that I wouldn't be here today if that wasn't of those attacks that I got very early on, because that also gave me a lot of sympathy from the public, from the audience in general, because, you know, people would be like, huh, so this person is making those groups angry, so that person must actually be pretty cool. That's how I work. You know, I look at who gets angry at who, and I'm like, okay, I choose my side. And this kind of polarization of the debate kind of put my comic on the spotlight, I feel. And that was the biggest challenge at first, but I also feel that it brought me a lot emotionally and in terms of support. I got a lot of support from people I had no clue who would be supporting me and stuff like that. So, yeah, that was the biggest issue, especially as a, you know, when you're doing trans activism online, like, maybe it seems easy from the outside to produce articles and or comics or anything. You know, you feel like you just do it, and it's out there, it's easy, but most of the people that I know that are producing content, I don't know about you, Sam, but most of the online trans activists that I know are go through that kind of things, and there's just nothing that authorities will do, and there's no way to fight back at them, especially as, you know, those groups have a lot of power. I mean, if you look at all the resources that websites like Reddit or 4chan can put together just to arrest somebody, it's pretty intense. And yeah, that makes it really precarious to decide to do this kind of job. But at the same time, it's a very difficult conversation, because I don't want anyone to think that they shouldn't do it, because it's vital. You know, we need visible people both online and outside the internet. The internet is a really nice place otherwise. I mean, I came out on the internet like many people, and overall, you know, the support is a lot bigger than the hate I get online. But yeah, it's always very, very a very sensitive subject.
I just wanted to say thank you, especially to Amy and Aaron, because I think it's really interesting. So I'm someone, and it's really interesting talking to people about gender and things, because they don't seem to understand that binary, and even like gender discourse in colonial context is very much a Western colonial thing structured around masculinity, you know? Like I was talking to a friend recently that there's no real translation for people of color who aren't transgender, but you kind of get placed into the cis thing, and it's really good to kind of hear both of you talk about the place that colonization has had in these discussions around fairness and gender. There's a lot of, statistically, I don't know if there are any Samoan people here, but people love to talk about fa'afafine and takasabui, and this is fetishization of those things, and then elitism, like, we can speak over you about your indigenous people, and yet, how do you deal with it? Because, like, our printed prisons have a lot of white followers, and it's really cool to hear that you're talking about, like, reflecting on the kind of problems that come up in organizing. How do you kind of navigate that thing where you ensure that your group, which is centered around indigenous people, how do you kind of navigate that thing of white people who, in theory, may support indigenous sovereignty, but in practice, subconsciously, unconsciously, kind of perpetuate that, I guess, further colonization?
Yeah, I don't want to list little flies on the mic, so I'll chuck it over at Aaron. And, it's really difficult organizing with Pākehās, and I don't think that that's because white people are made out of evil, or you know, if you cut the mayonnaise, will come out or anything. Like it's not a like an objective truth that white people can't have good politics or white people can't be part of the movement, because they can. Like white people have like the Panthers. White people have always been part of radical movements, and I think if you try to centre a radical movement on a kind of identitarian notion that there's the revolutionary class, which is solely marginalised people, and there's the enemy, and that's solely Pākehā or solely straight people, not only are you misrepresenting like who is actually capable of revolutionary labour, but you're throwing out a whole bunch of like potential foot soldiers, metaphorically, not actual soldiers. That was a joke. but yeah, and it's also there's a tension, because there will be like counter-revolutionary tendencies among those populations. But I mean, there's counter-revolutionary tendencies amongst every population. Brian Samaki is Māori, and he's still the worst piece of shit that I can think of. Yeah, it's difficult because not only do we live in the era of colonization, but we can still colonize ourselves. We can still, no, we couldn't. We can still perpetuate colonialism or colonial thinking in our own spaces. again, like Brian Samaki is a really good example, because he claimed that there was never any gay Māoris, and somehow also if there were ever any gay Māoris, they would have been executed. Somehow he managed to hold both of those opinions at once. But it's a great example of the kind of incoherent shit that you get when you try to think colonially, because it just doesn't make sense. That didn't make any sense. But, you know, Māori can still do that. So, you know, if we can do it, Pākehās definitely can do it, but, you know, that doesn't mean that we need to discard outright any population which is capable of having shit politics, because every population is capable of having shit politics. You know, I've I have had bad politics. You all have had bad politics, and in 5 years we'll probably think back of something that we think now and go, oof. I don't think that means that from the outset any kind of revolutionary movement is doomed. I really hope not, because otherwise there's no possibility for revolution, and I like to think that there is.
Yeah, that's completely something that I'm always mindful about and really aware of when I clock into work, and the community that I'm serving. You know, that I'm not perpetuating. And you touched on it before on the concept of takatāpui, that a lot of Māori people don't understand this concept, or the fact that, you know, acknowledge that there are, for layman terms, queer people in Māoridom, you know, but it's not for me to be like, did you know, you know, because that to me, I'm just like, you know, for someone like me who's also been colonized in the sense that I was ripped out from my you know, place of birth, and, you know, having to live in a colonized land and having everything pretty much taken away from me and having to learn my own language from Pākehā people and pay money at the University of frickin' Auckland by these American white people of my own language and my own culture has just been something that's truly, like, I wouldn't want that done upon somebody else, because I wouldn't want that to be done to me. But, you know, it's actually building, having and consenting for myself to be okay to have that brown voice, to be okay to have that, you know, like, if I need to put someone in line who, and my friends, that I don't want to be doing any more emotional labor with my Pākehā people. You know, I don't want to have to feel like, oh, sorry, did I hurt your feeling? Because I really didn't like the way that you kind of stepped over, you know, my whole aspects of me and my wairua, you know, like everything in that way, you know? So for me, I'm just like, that's negotiation with, I don't want to have to keep rehashing the same sort of, not just the aspect of trans identity, but as a person of color identity, that I have to do one-on-one every single day with the people that are close to me, that I want to just be able to move on. And even with my activism, that I can move on with it without having to rehash and all this kind of stuff over and over again, and having to always feel like, oh, sorry, did I hurt your feelings, you know, in that way, when I'm just trying to be me, you know? And I think with activism as well, like what you were saying, Simone, that how do we negotiate this kind of aspects? And I think, you know, for me, my time is valuable. What I do is valuable. And if people can't get that in that way in my everyday activism, then I just move on. You know, there's no point keep going back to hammer something that they're not there yet. And that's okay. You know, everything is a process. My whole journey is a process, and their journey is a process as well. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you. I think that we'll finish it there with those excellent points from both of you. And I just wanted to say thank you to all of you for your generosity and your knowledge. And I know that standing up, well, not necessarily standing, but being up the front, and sharing some of this stuff can be really hard, and particularly the fact that it's going to get recorded and go online can be a scary and vulnerable thing to do. So I really appreciate that, and thank you to the audience for your lovely questions and your engagement, and wanted to say thank you very much and let the audience give you a round of applause.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah.